This episode of Section D was first aired on Tuesday the 20th of November on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. For this week's show, we packed our passport and crystal balls and travelled from San Francisco to the Caribbean, from Dublin via London to Barcelona, to question the future of topics ranging from the Catalan city skyline to the environmental plausibility of the latest eco-toilets. As the year winds to a close, it's an opportunity not just to consider the year ahead, but to step back and consider how we might be living, what we might be wearing, what our houses might be built with, what they might contain, and where they might be located 10 or even 50 years from now. With that in mind, coming up on the show, we head to Haiti's first ever Fashion Week to find out if fashion is a future global industry for the Caribbean nation.
I've been excited like for 3 months, getting communication with the international, invite the designers, invite the international models. It was exciting, very exciting.
We take to the aisles of the Green Build Expo in San Francisco, the world's largest trade fair devoted to sustainable construction, to see how eco-powered urinals might change our lives.
It removes all kinds of waste using only 1 gallon of water. First time, every time.
And in Barcelona, we take an architour with local architect Francisco Sert, who dodges the cranes to show us how, despite a dire economy, the skyline has an exciting future ahead of it.
It's not simply a place of memories, but a space where our collective memory is constructed and reconstructed from a historical perspective.
More on that shortly. Elsewhere, we discuss how housing in London will cope with an increase in population to 10 million over the next 2 decades. We talk to Gianluca Armento of Cascina about how the heritage Italian brand is using old values to scope new markets. And in Dublin, we attend a talk about the role of women in design too. That's all to come on this week's episode of Section D here on Monocle 24. We begin this week's design trail in the self-proclaimed Mediterranean capital of Barcelona. It's a city that's never shied away from architectural flair. Barcelona's streets and neighbourhoods are a sprawling showcase of Catalonian audacity and ingenuity, evident in the fact that it's the only city to have ever been awarded Riba's Royal Gold Medal for Architecture, albeit back in 1999. But where is the city today? Despite the economic crisis, construction cranes still hover on the skyline. Plans continue to be drawn up by daring urbanists, and the architectural conversation is as lively as ever. We sent our correspondent Liam Aldus out onto the streets of the city with local architect Francisco Sert. They bypassed the more renowned historic districts and instead headed for some of the buildings that are fueling the local discussion today.
Hola, Paco, ¿qué tal?
¿Qué tal, Liam? ¿Cómo estás? ¿Qué? ¿Nos vamos ya o qué?
Sí, vamos ahora mismo.
Venga.
Even though it's November, the sun is still shining in Barcelona, and it's the perfect day to jump on the back of a scooter with Paco Sert for a tour of some of the city's architectural talking points. We start with a tribute to history, and a reminder of the political wounds from the Civil War that are yet to fully heal.
We're in front of what is called the Pavilion of the Republic, which was built as a replica in 1992 here in the upper part of Barcelona, in the Vall d'Hebron, for the Olympics, in 92 for the Olympics in Barcelona. And well, I'm going to talk about the original building, which was designed by Josep Lluís Sert and La Casa, the Spanish architects, in 1937 for the Paris World Fair. This building, it was designed as a propaganda building. It was just as a surface and a space in which to tell the story and the horrors of the war that was taking place in Spain from 36 to 39. So we were in the middle of the war.
So is this building significant because it's a way of reclaiming the past?
Yeah, of course. I think it's of great significance. The idea of doing a replica again and having it 50 or 80 years later back as it was, it's a way of making us not forget about what happened, of the horrors that happened in during the Spanish Civil War, and have a building that reminds us constantly of what which should have never happened and that should never happen again, which is to divide the country in two in a war.
And there's a sign here that describes the significance of the building. What about this part? Can you just read this part to me?
Well, actually, this part is I think is the key thing about this building today. It says the pavilion with its symbolic evocation of the Spanish Republic at war, and now a must-see shrine for anyone wishing to study and understand the 20th century in Spain and Catalonia. It's not simply a place of memories, but a space where our collective memory is constructed and reconstructed from a historical perspective. And people don't know this place. I think people should, because of the area, because if it's not, it's quite a bit away from the center, people don't come here and don't know about this building and what it meant and what it means now. But I think it's a must-see. It should be in Barcelona's tourist guides as a must-see, definitely.
We leave history behind and head towards a building that will surely form part of architectural discourse in the 21st century. It's Torre Julia, a high-rise residence with a fresh take on how to house Spain's aging population.
Hello, my name is Ricard Galeana. I'm one of the three architects that we have done the Torre Julia. The other ones are Sergi Pons and Pau Vidal. That unfortunately, they are not here today with us, but I'm going to show you the building. We have tried to make a building with the facilities that this kind of building has. As we were talking, it's not a residence. It just has these small facilities with small nurse and service and social assistant. But then the main thing in the building is it's a tower. And as a tower, we were trying to avoid a close communication core, trying to explode and putting these common spaces in the best places of the building, and also doing these wide corridors as streets, and also dividing the building in three communities, as each community is taking part of one of those common spaces. So we can see that the building is structured by the public or relation spaces and not by the private apartments. Being part of a community, that's what I try to do. They are inside of a building and they can have relations with the neighbors, and they have the space to have a good relation with the neighbors. That's the point.
Are you interested in seeing how the building works when it's full? Because obviously as an architect you can have an idea of how you want to encourage behavior, but when people move in often they use the building in a different way.
Of course, it's always a surprise, and you think a lot of stuff, how they're gonna use it, and hopefully they can use it. I mean, they can use it in the way that they want, but the important thing is that they use it and they have the space to use it.
Do you think this building reflects the Spanish character, and a lot of Spanish mentality has gone into, or Catalan character if you will, but the Spanish communitarian character of always spending time together, always being out in the street. Do you think this building really reflects communal living?
I don't know. Where are you living right now?
Madrid.
In Madrid. Because do you think that the Latin character is much more private in this way? Of course, we share public space or we can have contact with neighbors. But in the way of being part of a community, the Latins, we are much more private. We don't like to share at all. You can see people on streets with the share and sharing the public space and stuff like that. But then when you talk about community inside the dwelling, not at all. Big troubles to do things together and to
it's a bit of a paradox in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's part of character, I think. It's
So in a way, this building is trying to address this issue that maybe we like to be together, but not, as he's saying, not in a as part of a community. So this building is about a community.
We now move from talking about the creation of a community to the division of another. The snail-paced construction of Gaudí Sagrada Família continues to be the subject of debate, with the church's controversial completion not expected until the year 2026. While many Barcelonians have grown accustomed to the perpetual construction, Paco voices some of the lingering concerns about the project.
What's the issue, though? Is it that the rebuild is reinterpreting Gaudí's work, or is it that it's being built for religious purposes by religious people, or is it because it's actually just being rebuilt as a tourist beacon to get more money? Is this the issue at the heart of...
All of the above, basically. I think, of course, the people behind building, making the decisions of... they are a religious community, part of the Catholic Church. You know, they want the church to be completed. Not necessarily in Gaudí's style, not necessarily with Gaudí's genius behind. I think these people are quite mediocre from the artistic point of view. But we can discuss a lot about if it's really necessary and if Gaudí can be completed. I think it's impossible to complete Gaudí in the same way that it's impossible to complete any other great genius from the architectural world or from the artistic world. Is it possible to finish a Picasso? Could we have an artist from the 21st century complete a painting that wasn't completed by Picasso? Is it possible? Are we going to notice a difference?
Do you think this huge lion we see right in front of us that's snaking right around the block will care in the end? Will they still flock to see the La Sagrada Família, even if it's not purely Gaudí?
I don't think so. I don't think most of the people that come here know exactly what is going on, but they see like a huge structure being built. I've seen what it's inside, and it's quite a spectacular space, that's for sure.
That was our correspondent Liam Aldus being led around Barcelona's future architectural hotspots by local architect Francisco Sert. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. We'll be taking our seat on the front row of Haiti's first Fashion Week after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. Our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
The power of photography was pulled into focus at this year's Pre-Pic Day, the world's leading prize for photography in the realm of sustainability.
These are true artists, and they have incredible integrity. I mean, they tell you how it is. In the process, it's often disturbing. Sometimes it's beautiful in an abstract way, but it really touches a nerve.
Monocle Films attended the awards, and you can watch our film in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D. Haiti's relationship with textiles and fashion goes back many generations. But as with so many small countries in recent decades, its garment industry has all but disappeared. To succeed in the fashion business these days, most Haitian designers must travel abroad to show their collections, or satisfy themselves with a miniature local market. But that may be about to change. This past week, Haiti hosted its first ever Fashion Week. It was an opportunity not only to show the history and depth of the creative industry in the Caribbean nation, still struggling to rebuild itself after the 2010 earthquake, but it was also an opportunity to look ahead and imagine what the future might be for Haiti's fashion industry, as our reporter Jessica Lindsay discovered.
Makeup artist Maï Kadu's mask of patience is slipping. He needs bodies in his makeup chair. Models lounging in underwear look up from their takeaway dinners of Creole chicken and fried plantain. We're backstage on the final night of Haiti's first ever Fashion Week. For 4 days, the country's well-heeled have gathered at the five-star Caribe Hotel in the Tony Hilltop Port-au-Prince suburb of Pétionville. They've come to see the collections of some of Haiti's most celebrated designers, among them Maël David, Maggy Dursay, and David André. They've come to support what they hope will be something all Haitians can celebrate and benefit from, the rebirth of the beleaguered nation's textile and apparel industry. Back at the hair and makeup station, Fashion Week organizer and designer Michel Chatang is giving orders.
All right, you could cut it, please.
Chatang is something of a legend here in Haiti. 29 years ago, at the age of 19, he opened his first beauty salon in downtown Port-au-Prince.
I've been the first man in that industry. And people were so exciting. A lot of people coming in my beauty salon just curiously to see a man do hair for women, you know?
After 10 years of growing his hair and makeup business, Chatang left home for North Carolina and Paris, where he studied fashion design. When he returned to Haiti a few years later, he opened a beauty school and an atelier to teach what he had learned. In many ways, Fashion Week is the culmination of Chatang's life's work to this point. The artists backstage have all been trained by him. The makeup they use bears his name. His experience showing on runways overseas is evident in his sure-handed stage management. And as a member of the Haiti Association of Designers, his pride in the work of his colleagues and his advocacy on their behalf has found the perfect outlet.
I've been exciting like for 3 months, getting communication with the international, invite the designers, invite the international models. It was exciting, very exciting. And I think it was a very, very good experience for all the Haitian designers.
Chatang's experience and pride in country also shows in his collection.
That fabric you see, this is the old fabric from Haiti. They call it Siam. We used to make it here in Haiti, back of the day. And I want to come back with it. The print, you see, I made the print.
Chatang's talents and care to detail have earned him attention and accolades from all over the world. But none of that matters to Chatang if the industry here in his own country, now hanging by a thread, cannot support him and his colleagues.
Haitian people can't really afford our creation, because to do a creation here, it costs money.
A lot of money. Fabric is difficult to source on the island. Modern machines, the kind that help with productions, are scarce. No shops make buttons or zippers. Electricity is unstable at best, and generators expensive to run. Workshop space is also at a premium, as many designers lost their ateliers in the earthquake. To survive, Haiti's designers must capture the imagination of the international fashion community. And Fashion Week is one way to do just that.
Each people who buys a piece of me helped me to keep that atelier. That's why I'm hoping tonight to show those people all over the world, this is the work I'm doing.
For Chatang, Fashion Week is also about showing the world what Haiti can do and how much more it could do with the resources most countries take for granted.
I think we are creators, Haitian people. We are. We have it in blood. I think that part we need to showcase, to make people know what kind of work we can do.
Chatang's not alone in seeing the potential here. After the earthquake, the governments in Haiti and the U.S. made the revival of the garment industry a key part of their economic recovery plan. Last month, foreign dignitaries and Hollywood stars were on hand to open a huge new garment factory in the north of the country. On a smaller scale, the Clinton-Bush Fund donated $850,000 toward the creation of a modern atelier in Port-au-Prince. Chatang envisions a space with all the tools necessary to support designers from pattern making through final production. With the momentum of the plant opening, a successful fashion week, and the construction of the atelier on the horizon, Chatang hopes others will be inspired to invest in the industry and further drive down the cost of production for higher-end clothing designers.
What I really hope is to have a company who can come to do the fabric for us, to have them here. This is the most important thing, atelier and fabric.
Designer Nadine Jerome sees a lot of optimism and opportunity in Fashion Week as well. Born and raised in Port-au-Prince, Jerome now lives and practices in the U.S. She hadn't been home in more than 15 years.
Although it was heartbreaking, you know, coming from the airport to get here and to see how the country is, you know, so broken. But I believe that as more things like this take place in different, you know, industries and so on, it's going to really help to bring the country back.
In the meantime, Chatang has a show to put on. The ballroom has been beautifully staged, everything in white, from the catwalk to the draped ceiling. Every one of the 1,000 white chairs in the room is filled. Latecomers line the walls. One of President Michel Martelly's sons is making his way through the crowd to the front row, shaking hands and doling out kisses. Also in the front row is Jimmy Moise, a Miami-based fashion show producer and the driving force behind Fashion Loves Haiti, a post-earthquake fundraising campaign. He's a man who knows a good fashion week when he sees one.
So far, so good. You know, I have to say, you know, I see that we have very great turnout the past couple of days. And the designers, so far, they're up to par. You know, they are really meeting up to the challenge. You know, of course, there are some, quite a few bugs to be ironed out, but I think that we're on the right track.
In the ballroom, there's no reserved seating for VIPs like agents, buyers, and sponsors. And in true Haitian style, the first model hits the runway almost 2 hours after the advertised start time. But for the most part, these complaints are minor and are quickly forgiven with the surprise appearance of opera star Fabienne Denis, who rouses the crowd with a rendition of the traditional Haitian folk song, Yo Yo. Michel Chatain's collection follows Denis' performance. It earns him some of the biggest applause of the night and a standing ovation when he takes his turn on the stage. Back in the dressing room, glass of wine and cigarette in hand, his message is simple.
Waiting for you.
That was our reporter Jessica Lindsay in Haiti at the Caribbean nation's inaugural Fashion Week there. And from fibres to foundations, we head to San Francisco next. No Section D would be complete without a trade fair of some description, and this week we hit the Californian city, a favourite of mine, of course, to tackle the heavy topic of sustainability and construction. There aren't many trade fairs where you'll find the latest toilets alongside manufacturers of high-tech glass and recycling bins, but Greenbuild has all this and much more on offer. Monocle's San Francisco correspondent, Alistair G, went along to the annual show for the green building industry and brought back this report.
So this is our eighth of a gallon urinal with our EcoPower technology. This is our commercial wall-hung toilet. Again, it has the EcoPower technology.
In a gargantuan exhibition center in San Francisco, 900 companies and almost 30,000 visitors have come together for the world's largest conference and expo devoted to green building. Firms offering everything from green roofs to energy-saving windows, and yes, eco-friendly toilets, are proffering their wares.
So we're introducing our Drake 2 1G, which is a game changer in the high efficiency category. It's an ultra high efficiency toilet. It removes all kinds of waste using only 1 gallon of water. First time, every time.
Launched in 2002, the Green Build Expo is organized by the US Green Building Council, which developed the LEED certification scheme. To get a sense of just how much the green building industry has grown, you only have to look at the number of LEED certified buildings, say Selena Holmes of the Green Building Council.
After, I would say in 2002, there were about 590 LEED projects, and they were only in 7 countries. And if you take a look at today, where we've got about 163,000 LEED projects worldwide, they're in 135 countries.
Out on the expo floor, you might expect that yuppie-ish sandal-wearing types would predominate, but there's actually a sizable contingent of men and women in business casual, hailing from solid middle American states like Michigan and Kentucky. Some of the products on display are relatively banal, like efficient piping and flooring. Others are more high-tech, such as the tintable windows of the kind that are found on Boeing's new Dreamliner.
If you look at a building where most of the energy is lost or gained that you have to get rid of through heating and air conditioning, that actually happens at the building facade, and primarily that happens through the windows. So as a result of that, the windows are actually a critical point in managing energy efficiency of a building.
Jeff Kirsten works at View, which offers glass that can be shaded from almost transparent to very dark. They enable a striking reduction in energy consumption.
In many types of commercial buildings, we can save up to between 20 and 30% of heating and air conditioning costs.
But companies at Greenbuild weren't just appealing to customers' consciences and wallets. They acknowledged that eco-friendly design can also be, for want of a better word, pretty. Take green roofs.
A lot of people will talk to you about stormwater, a lot of really positive benefits, but the aesthetic values that you get from these roofs in an urban environment, I think, are paramount. You just really improve the look in various roof environments.
David Frost of Live Roof has installed green roofs at sites as diverse as the doghouse in his yard to Los Angeles City Hall. He says that another upside also isn't to do with the environment per se. It's about creating pleasant spaces where people can gather.
What I've noticed with some of our jobs is we put the roof on and it's next to a building that has access to that, offices or what have you. And that first you see people responding, oh, that's beautiful. And then next thing you go back a few times and they've got a chair and tables out there, even though it wasn't designed specifically for that.
Elsewhere in the Expo Center, I couldn't help but suspect some firms and organizations of greenwashing. Companies whose products help customers reduce consumption of raw materials and electricity had branded themselves as green rather than simply efficient. Even the green credentials of plastic were being played up. The Vinyl Institute, a trade organization for vinyl manufacturers, had a cheery, professional-looking stand.
When you consider sustainable products, you have to consider durability and full life cycle. And so vinyl products have a very long lifespan, allowing them to provide useful service for many, many years without the need for replacement or maintenance.
I suppose if you accept that something is green by virtue of being durable, then plastic doesn't seem so bad, though I'm not sure I follow this. The Institute also emphasizes that vinyl doesn't come from oil.
Vinyl is a plastic, although we differ from other plastics in that the bulk of our products are made from salt and natural gas, especially products manufactured in the US.
There you go then. Organizations in the hall weren't just trying to sell visitors on new products, however. They were also warning them off ones that aren't particularly green.
We have a big poster with a couch on it, and there's two questions. Is this the most dangerous thing in your house, and it shows a couch? And the second question, or is it your foam insulation?
These representatives from the respected Green Science Policy Institute in Berkeley were highlighting the health dangers of the chemical flame retarders added to much of the furniture produced in California. Still, visitors to the expo, such as April Ambrose, a lead expert from Arkansas, weren't letting that sort of thing get them down.
I love coming to Greenville. I think this is my fourth one now, and I always come to be inspired and get passionate and kind of renewed, since most of my job is kind of in front of a computer screen. It's good to see the people aspect.
It is indeed affirming to see so many people committed to building in a more ecologically friendly manner. While in some cases it seems that proponents are more committed to the idea in word rather than spirit, the Greenbuild Expo turns out to be a broad church where all are welcome. For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alastair G.
Thank you very much, Alastair. In January next year, we'll be reporting from BAU, the Munich beer moth of a fair that deals with the global construction industry. It'll be interesting to see how much from Greenbuild has trickled into the mainstream. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. And sticking to the topic of construction, we're back in London now. Over the next 20 years, London's population is expected to grow to over 10 million people. Of course, the hot question on developers, architects and urbanists' lips is, where is everyone going to live? The city's growth represents a huge challenge to create sustainable, affordable and livable housing. But it's an opportunity too. Monocle's James Pearson attended the opening of an exhibition on the topic of London's future housing solutions, fittingly at the new London Architecture headquarters.
Look up at the skyline of London and you might think it's a beehive of construction, with new skyscrapers shooting up all the time. But one aspect of the city is slow to change, its houses. To keep its growing population in check, the capital needs to build around 36,000 new homes a year. Yet far fewer are actually being built. With space and cost at a premium, architects have to be creative on the small plots of land that do become free. This month, the Independent Forum, New London Architecture, have launched Housing London, an exhibition showcasing the designs architects are coming up with to tackle these problems. I asked New London's chairman, Peter Murray, if new styles of housing are emerging.
Some of it's going back to previous examples of the way we do things. I think that it's interesting to look at what sorts of designs we're doing, and the mayor, Boris Johnson, is very keen to create housing which responds to what he calls London's DNA, and he's searching for a new London vernacular, something about its historical characteristic, but a contemporary design that reflects that. So if you imagine that sort of Georgian Terrace house really is the classic image of living in London, it's what people aspire to. It's something which has been able to adapt over the years. People have changed it. It's been they've been divided into flats and then into single family homes. It's a very good way of living in the city. So how do you do that with a contemporary design? And a number of architects are investigating that. And so that you have houses that with front doors that look out onto streets that have something of the feeling of the traditional London, but are a contemporary interpretation of that.
Seven of the residential builds showcased at Housing London are designed by architects Lifschutz, Davidson, Sunderlands. I went to the white stucco streets of Bayswater in West London to meet partner Alex Lifschutz, who's embraced the terraced townscape.
The housing was quite shoddily built, but the technology of the time, brick and timber and a little bit of stone, but basically brick and timber construction, meant that that the houses were quite robust, and they serve as well, as you can hear from the knocking sound here. We're going past a huge building site where three or four terraces are being knocked about, probably knocked together. So the form of the terrace is retained, but the insides are being changed around. That form has now been taken up quite extensively. So at Coin Street, where we worked, we've been working for 25 years, at the Athletes' Village in Stratford, we're using courtyard housing forms, which really have derived from this area here and these areas of London and major cities in the UK. We're using that form to create apartments around a central courtyard, and that seems to be quite a successful new London vernacular. One of the large projects that we're working on is the Ferrier Estate at Kidbrook in southeast London. Around 4,000 are being built along a master plan that we've designed, and a new park is being created. But the forms are much more urban forms that you would be able to recognise walking around London than traditional urban forms, that is, than they are the old council estate that we've knocked down.
The attractive Georgian and Victorian terraces were built on a grand scale, but what can architects do when only small plots of land are available? I've come out to the east end of London to see a new residential build and its architect.
This is the sound of our building. Clay engineering bricks, very solid. You might say that the Englishman's home is his castle, and I think people enjoy living in a place that's solid and well built and will stand the test of time, and that's one of the things we've looked to achieve with this material. It's also a case that brick is obviously a very English and certainly a very London material, and it helps us define an architecture that's coherent with the surroundings. It doesn't need much maintenance, because obviously maintenance is such an issue in terms of ongoing costs for building owners.
Tim Bell from Bell Phillips Architects specialises in modern residential buildings. Their six dwelling structures, Sherwood Terrace, has faced up to the challenges of building in a crowded, costly city.
It's an extremely dense scheme. It's about 830 habitable rooms per hectare, which is much higher than you tend to get in this area. And we've achieved that by building on nearly the whole of the site, so there's virtually no garden at the back on the north facing rear of the building, but instead all the external amenity is at the top floor on a large south facing terrace, and there it's actually much more usable and valuable. It gets great sun, it gets great views over the rooftops towards Excel and the docks beyond.
And another thing that seems to conform very nicely with is just the elevation, the height of the other buildings along the street. We're in a sort of typical East End London terraced street, and the door comes straight onto the street like the houses further down the road. Was that something that you designed, making sure it was in keeping with the rest of the area?
That's right. So while the materials here, the blue engineering brick and the copper cladding, are quite unusual, the form and the topology in terms of the houses is very relevant to the streetscape. So as you say, the doors come straight off the street. There's just very narrow front gardens that give a bit of privacy and security, and the main mass of the building is two stories high, which relates to the eaves level of the existing terraces, and then the second story above that sits back to the line of the apex of the existing houses, so it actually fits very well with the line of terraces along the street.
Do you think this form of sort of a terrace basis is coming back in London?
I think so. I mean, people seem to enjoy living in houses more than flats, but it depends where you go. Certainly the townhouse terrace is very useful in as much as it gives you more development per plot than a two-storey house would do. And as I say, the terrace at the top also helps you achieve that.
Do you think enough time goes into to housing in general? Time and thought?
Absolutely not. I would say that the vast majority of housing I see in the UK is monotonous and not sufficiently considered. Some of it is commercial pressures, but I really do think the level of design seriously needs a shake-up. There needs to be much more thought and time spent designing things, but again, it's a commercial problem so much of the time.
With this build, you got around that commercial problem because you've kept it low budget and you made it sustainable, and it's appealing to people who want to move into the area.
That's right. I mean, I hope that this project demonstrates that it's possible to go so much further in terms of design quality and thought without adding any more cost. And we'd like to see more of that happening in housing throughout the country.
That was Monocle reporter James Pearson at the New London Architecture Exhibition, Housing London. Visit newlondonarchitecture.org for more details and do pop along. It's fascinating. Still to come, we quiz Gianluca Armento, brand director of Cascina, about the Italian firm's future. And we'll be asking if women design differently to men. But first, a short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Now, of all the Italian furniture manufacturers, Cascina tells the story of the past and present better than any other. Founded in 1927 in the Brianza region, it counts in its I Maestri, or Masters, archive many of the most recognisable furniture designs from the 20th century by the likes of Le Corbusier, Giaponti, Vico Magistretti and Gaetano Pesce, to name just a smattering. Unlike many Italian brands, though, impressively, given its heritage, it's not one to rest on its laurels of former success. Proving that it strives still to innovate, this year it launched a new sofa system from young Italian design star Luca Nicchetto. And it sees the value of pushing hard in difficult financial times, not pinching at the purse strings in the hope that it will pull through. Last week it opened its first London showroom, and I spoke with Cascina's brand director Gianluca Armento to find out a little more about this refreshing business strategy.
Well, Japan is, for Cascina, the third biggest market worldwide, and we have a presence there that was established more than 30 years ago, and hence it is a market which we follow up on regularly, and we try and contribute to its growth as much as we can. The purpose of this visit was also to showcase our new sofa by Luca Nicchetto called Lamise, for which we did a nice four-day tour around our Japanese showrooms. We have four there, and we had many meetings with local architects and aficionados.
Why do you think Japan is such a big market for Cascina? I mean, you could instantly assume that it must be something to do with their appreciation of the craftsmanship and the history and the heritage of so many of the pieces. But certainly there are many other Italian brands that haven't had anything like the success of Cascina there.
Exactly. It all started that way, but it also started thanks to the passion of entrepreneurs which had the foresight to start many years ago and establish for Cascina a positioning which is unparalleled, and which is also an example for us in the rest of the world, because they have created a truly elite brand based on its extreme search for quality, as you were saying, and which is really appreciated in that market.
And does that reflect it throughout the rest of Asia as well? Or are you using Japan as a foothold to sort of enter other Asian markets?
It's completely different, firstly because of the right partnership we found many years ago. Secondly, for the sophistication of that market. We do believe the other Asian markets can accelerate and grow, but we have a lot of work to do, starting from the right partnerships. And where we have the right partnerships, these are relatively young. And hence, to develop also the clientele takes time. The networking is something you need to invest in regularly. So we do expect the countries to grow as they are growing, but it will take time for us to develop such a fertile business as the Japanese one.
Almost a week after Japan Casino came en masse to London to open a showroom in west of the city. Is London presumably a big market for you if you're investing in a showroom at a time when there's very little money to be spent on furniture and design here in this city, it feels?
I think it's one of the best things we've done this year because it is a very belated investment. I always talk about, you know, tradition and investment over time for Casina to be developed. And we opened Paris 40 years ago. Japan, the Japanese business is 30 years old. And it is quite shocking that London was not, let's say, graced with a West Side presence of Casina before now. And hence it is long overdue. And even though the situation is tight this year, of course, it is something which we are sure is going to be a on the map for in the next 20 years for a hallmark of Casino's development in Europe and globally, because London could not miss from our map. And it is really truly shocking that we're not present. We haven't been present in the past.
And you still believe as a brand that opening physical retail showrooms is definitely a wiser investment than pushing online retail?
I think the physical presence and the ability for a showroom to be a springboard for networking and contacts is key, and it is proven in New York and Los Angeles and in Tokyo and Milan, and hence London belongs to this pattern. Definitely so, because the brand is still a very well-known secret, a little-known secret among the fraternity, and we have to disclose it and be a bit less shy. So I think the online does not really has a big gap in the physical appreciation that furniture needs to have. So definitely brick and mortar is still on for Casina, and London is finally on the map.
Hear, hear. And I want to finally ask you about the investment in some new products as well. I mean, over the last few years, Casino's showcases have, as well as introducing one or two very key pieces, new pieces by young designers to the catalogue, has been focusing on bringing out older pieces from sort of the archives. Is that a way of sort of saving money, or is it investing in the past to kind of really shore up the brand values of Casino rather than just shoving out endless new products by young designers at each fair?
I think we're graced with a daunting task in Casino, which is having the necessity to keep innovating on the Masters collection. Innovating in inverted commas, like you have to bring news to the classics to keep them alive, and that is a full-time job. But at the same time, inventing new articles and bringing out and supporting new designers is also part of the Casino tradition, which frankly we had slowed down a bit in the past decade, and we need to make more vigorous. So doing the two things at the same time is absolutely fundamental for the survival of the brand, which also keeps us, though, in a good positioning versus competition, because there's very few other companies that can do and need to do the same thing. Hence, the need to work with designers like Luca Nichetto while working with Piero Lissoni, who also designed the showroom in London and who's been working with us for 20 years. So managing these two things at the same time is necessary. And working on the archives is not just a financial necessity. It is something of great strategic importance, because few other companies in the world have this kind of heritage and treasure. And hence it is absolutely paramount to keep it alive.
That was brand director of Casina, Gianluca Armento, there. And from London, we're off to Dublin next, where a curiously unaddressed topic in the world of design was recently given an airing. Do women design differently to men? Do they have other inspiration or concerns when they set about drawing up plans as architects, graphic designers, or as people who use their creative skills to reflect on the use of space? A recent event in Dublin brought together three women to talk about these questions. The all-female speakers discussed their inspiration, strategy, approach, priorities. From designer Eileen Gray's curator to the head of design for what used to be Design for London and is now called the Olympic Park Legacy Project, as well as a wayfinding expert who makes the signs for the V&A in London. The event was called Women Influencing Design, and we sent along our reporter, Louise Williams.
A design event isn't a design event without some sort of a beautifully designed gimmick, right? So I got an envelope when I came in. Inside the envelope is this, I suppose it's kind of a token, if you like. It's yellowy-green perspex. It's sort of semi-transparent and printed in it on one side. It's about the size of my hand and it's a rectangle. Printed in it, women influencing design, the dates and the times. And then onto the right-hand side, there are two tokens. Let's call them tokens. Each of them is a square and they're attached on just by a very small sliver. So hopefully I can just pop them off. Anyway, in each of these slivers, there's been a cut-out shape, right? And the cut-out shape is a glass of wine. So I guess that's a token for a glass of wine later. Let's see if I can just knock this token off now. Yeah. So three speakers and a few hours, hopefully some discussion. Loads of women here, a good few men as well, all ages, good few students from the looks of it. It's going to be a lively evening.
Be informed about something really interesting, what's going on at the moment.
Are you in design yourself?
We're all in industrial design in our fourth year.
We haven't really noticed a difference in our design work, but maybe we approach it differently, but we're all very individual anyway, so I don't really think that it has a massive difference, gender, you know, on the actual final product. I think maybe sometimes the men would have more of, because they'd been encouraged to look into more technical things from a younger age, and maybe girls hadn't been encouraged to do woodwork or tech graphics and things like that, they would have a different influence to the one we'd have, so maybe we would maybe, in general, have a more creative approach to design.
My name is Jennifer Goff. I'm curator of furniture, the Eileen Gray Collection and Archive, Musical and Scientific Instruments with the National Museum of Ireland.
That's a long title.
Yes, it's a long title with lots of collections, but it's a thoroughly enjoyable job.
And you're here tonight, I suppose partly because Eileen Gray is such an icon in design and you've got lots of insights into her life.
She has literally been 11 years of my life and research. So as a formidable woman of design, but not only design, you know, superb artist, which many people don't realise, incredible photographer, and also a self-taught architect. She was really quite a Renaissance woman for the modern times.
Do you see that she brought some sort of a female aesthetic to it?
I think Eileen was able to have that ability of a biodiversity with her designs. She designed specifically for the client that used the object, whether it was a man or a woman, or even if it was a child. And she completely engaged herself in the psychology of the human being, how somebody sat, how they ate, how they slept. And her designs were changed and worked in accordance with how somebody used the object.
So I'm Eleanor Fawcett and I'm the head of design at the London Legacy Development Corporation. Thinking about empathy, it's actually really interesting, and I see design in a much, I guess in a more profound way really, where it's about how design can improve people's lives and improve people's environments, and that's something that's kind of always interested me from when I was an architect and has kind of, you know, led me to the type of work that I'm doing now, where frankly I rarely concern myself with commenting on details of like architectural design or that kind of thing. It's much more about, well, what's the place we're making here and how are the people relating to that place, I guess. And I think that's obviously something that's very pertinent to Lucy's work as well, because it's all about how people relate to their places in a really sort of natural, intuitive way.
Lucy Holmes, and I'm graphic designer, creative director of Holmes Wood in London.
I asked a question there about what you bring to your work as designers and whether it had something to do with being a woman, and I thought you just were a bit uncomfortable with the question. I thought it chafed a little.
Well, I think it's a really difficult one. I'm not for sort of positive discrimination. I've thought a lot over the last couple of weeks about whether the way I am is because I'm a woman or because I'm just a professional, and I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are things that happen in my studio that happen because two women run it.
I suppose I sort of struggle to comment intelligently on this whole issue of what one should do or what special skills being a woman gives you. It feels as if the role of architect as, you know, ego, genius, is kind of over a little bit. And actually, I pick up on more of an interest in architecture as a training for how you shape cities. In London, there's quite a few really interesting, very young, recently graduated architects, you know, not just from undergrad, even not even having finished their diploma, who've set themselves up as little groups. Like there's one called Assemble, who we're working with quite a lot, who just build stuff with communities. It's really interesting, and it's true that a lot of them are female as well.
I've spoken to a couple of my friends tonight that we all did industrial design and graphic design, and we're all talking about how we feel really inspired now, and how, you know, you're going to go into work tomorrow with a bang, being like, I'm a woman, I could do this, you know, look at me go, which it's just inspirational. It's not that it's not that there aren't women doing this, it's just to showcase it and to kind of have some inspiration.
Empathy, cajoling, bullying, timing, cooperation, collaboration. I don't know, all these words have been flying around the room. But this evening was about insight into how women can influence design on so many levels.
That was Louise Williams there at the Women Influencing Design event in Dublin recently. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we'll be attending the Sleep Expo here in London. We'll be dipping into Dennis Lasden's archives at the RIBA, and we'll talk restoration and refurbishment with Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, plus much more besides. So be sure to tune in then. This show was produced by Gillian Tobias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out in honour of the construction theme in this week's show, here's Build Me Up Buttercup by The Foundations. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.